It's been said that true worship is a response to what God has done or is doing in our lives. There's good reason for that. Listen to the words of Psalm 116, verse 1. I love the Lord, for He heard my voice. He heard my cry for mercy. Because He turned His ear to me, I will call on Him as long as I live. Why does the psalmist worship? Because God has heard his prayer because of what God has done for him. The same is true for us. Worship is our response to who God is and what God is doing in our lives. And that's the pattern that we see here in the book of Joshua. God acts, and then in response, the people worship. And we come to an instance of that again this morning. Last week, we looked at how the Israelites were able to defeat the city of Ai after suffering a previous defeat in battle against them. By obeying God and seeking God, God heard Israel's prayer, moved on their behalf, and gave them victory. And their response is to once again worship God. God acts, and His people worship. Listen to what happens after Israel won that victory. Starting in verse 30 of chapter 8. At that time, Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, on Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the people of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses. An altar of uncut stones, upon which no man has wielded an iron tool. And they offered on it burnt offerings to the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. And there in the presence of the people of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. And all Israel, sojourner as well as native born, with their elders and officers and their judges, stood on opposite sides of the ark before the Levitical priests who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Half of them in front of Mount Gerizim and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded at the first to bless the people of Israel. And afterward, he read all the words of the law and the blessing and the curse according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses commanded that Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel and the women and the little ones and the sojourners who lived among them. Israel gathers to consecrate themselves before the Lord, to worship the Lord, as they've done throughout the book of Joshua. Back in the 1500s, a French mathematician, philosopher, named Blaise Pascal noted that each one of us has a God-shaped hole at the center of our being that only God can fill. And what he meant was that we were created with the need to have God at the very center of our lives. That hole was created when Adam and Eve sinned and there was this separation from God. We were created to live in shalom, in perfect harmony with God, and sin separated that and it created this cavity, this void that only God can fill. And in our rebellion against God, we look to other things to try to fill that God-shaped hole. As we sit here this morning, each of us, whether we realize it or not, we've got that hole in our lives. And each of us, whether we realize it or not, is spending our life trying to find something to fill that hole with. And when we try to fill that hole with something other than God, rather than finding happiness and contentment, we find emptiness, discontentment, and even bitterness. Why? Because when we try to fill that hole with something other than God, we begin to serve a master that is never satisfied. Money, materialism, it's such an easy example to use to illustrate what we're talking about here. Think about people you know who've tried to fill the emptiness, that hole in their life, with money or with things. How many of those people are truly content with what they have? Isn't it true that every one of them, without exception, enough is never enough? The only people who are content with material things are people who don't really care about material things. If that's what you're living for, enough is never enough. Why? Man was created to live in perfect unity with God. But when man sinned, that unity was broken, creating a God-shaped hole, a void in our lives. God is infinite and eternal, so the hole that was created is infinite and eternal. Do you understand what that means? You cannot fill the infinite with something that's finite. Money is finite. And if you're trying to fill that infinite God-shaped hole with something finite, there's never going to be enough to fill it up. And so what happens when you try to fill the infinite with the finite is that you create a task that is never finished. I'm not much on Greek mythology, but there's one myth that's always caught my attention. It's the myth of Sisyphus, a king who angered the Greek god Zeus. Because he angered Zeus, Sisyphus was condemned to spend the rest of his life trying to push a huge boulder up a mountain. And of course, every time he started to make some progress, eventually the boulder would roll back down the hill and he'd have to start all over again. And that's what our lives are like if we are trying to fill this God-shaped hole with anything other than God. If you're trying to fill this God-shaped hole with anything other than God, you've created an impossible task for yourself. And you'll become a slave to whatever that thing is, because enough will never be enough. Solomon understood this when he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. Remember, Solomon had it all. He had everything. But listen to what he said. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. And then a few verses later in Ecclesiastes 6:7, all man's efforts are for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. Now, some of you may be thinking, I see this point when it comes to money and material things. I hate materialism. I value relationships. I invest in people. That's a good thing to invest in. It really is. But if you're trying to fill that God-shaped hole with relationships with people rather than God, you still have an appetite that will never be satisfied. Why? Because just like money and things, people aren't infinite. People aren't eternal. People aren't unchanging. Here's a depressing thought. Aren't you glad you came here this morning to hear this? Every human relationship you have is going to end in sadness one day. Why? Because people change. And because of this curse of sin, there's a truth that we can't get away from, and that is that each of us one day is going to die, and every relationship we have, every human relationship, is going to come to an end one day. Human relationships are good things. They're wonderful things. Money and material possessions, they're good things, but those good things can't be ultimate things because they aren't infinite. And they can't fill up that infinite void, that God-shaped hole. Whatever you're living for that's not God is never going to completely satisfy you, because you'll never have enough of it, and it can't possibly begin to fill up that empty place in your life. Whatever you put your trust in that isn't God is sooner or later going to disappoint you, because only God is infinite, eternal, and unchanging. As Israel came into the promised land and they began to take possession of it, there'd be many things beside God that could capture their attention, that they could try to fill that God-shaped hole with. And God knew that it would be easy for Israel to be distracted as they went and began to take possession of the land. In fact, He warned them about it in the book of Deuteronomy. There were still enemies to defeat. There were fields to plant. There were cities to build and homes to build. And it would be easy for those things to become the center of Israel's existence there in the Promised Land, to distract them from God. There were false gods, the false gods that the Canaanites worshipped. It would be easy, and in fact would happen. Israel would begin to worship those gods in years to come. The distractions were everywhere. And the whole purpose of this ceremony that we just read about in Joshua 8 was to remind Israel of what was really important. To remind Israel of what had to be at the center of their life, of what had to be filling that God-shaped hole. I want you to notice what was at the very center of that ceremony that we just read about in Joshua 8. It was the presence of God. Everything is centered around the Ark of the Covenant. To help us understand that, let's set the scene. Joshua is doing exactly what God commanded Israel to do. If you go back to Deuteronomy 27, we won't look at it right now, but you can look at it when you get home if you want to. God laid out what's taking place here in Joshua 8. There were two mountains, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. The Israelites were to be divided in half, six tribes on one mount, six tribes on the other mount, and the ark in the center in a valley below. And as Israel gathered together, the law of God was to be read. And the people on Mount Ebal would pronounce curses on those who did not keep the law, and the people on Mount Gerizim would pronounce blessings on those who kept the law. Down in the valley were the priests and Joshua and the Ark of the Covenant at the center of it all. Setting the people up like this, it created a natural amphitheater. Back in Tennessee, people would have called it a holler, where your voice would carry and everyone could hear what you were saying. But that was not why it was set up this way. It wasn't just for acoustical purposes. It was set up this way because God wanted the ark to be at the center of His people. As you read through the Old Testament, the ark's always right there in the center of the camp, in the center of everything Israel's doing, to remind people that God had to be at the center of everything. Like I said before, there were all kinds of things that could distract the Israelites. Things that they could be busy trying to fill that God-shaped hole with. Things that in the end would only bring trouble to them if they tried to substitute those things for God. The Israelites are just like us. We too have all kinds of things that can easily distract us, don't we? We have our work, we have our possessions, we have our kids' activities. They can all become things that we live for, that take center stage in our life, that we use to try to fill that emptiness, that hole up in our lives. And most of us, we don't mean for that to happen. We don't set out for that to happen. It just does over the course of time. We begin to think that we have to have these things in order to be happy and comfortable and secure. And so we begin to live for those things and pursue those things. And the more we pursue those good things, the more they become like a god, an idol to us, and begin to enslave us. I can speak with authority on this because I've been enslaved by all these things. I spent most of my adult life chasing the American dream, chasing dreams for my kids. And those are good things, but I realize they can't be the ultimate thing. As good as those things may be, they can't take the place of a vital, meaningful relationship with God. And if you pursue those things rather than God, you're still going to have that God-shaped hole in your life because those things can't fill you up. Augustine once said, "Our hearts are restless until we find our rest in You." And Jesus, in Matthew, He promised us that rest. We looked at that earlier this morning. Israel was moving into a land flowing with milk and honey. And so the thing that most obviously could have distracted them was the prosperity of the land. And God told them back in the book of Deuteronomy, when you come into the land and you begin to settle in there, don't fall into the illusion of thinking that you've earned all this, that you've created all this prosperity for yourselves. Always remember that it is I who's given it to you, and always have a grateful heart. There were homes and cities to build, farmlands to cultivate. Rather than loving and serving God with all their heart and soul and strength, they could spend their days so easily working like crazy, trying to create prosperity and wealth, pushing God out to the very edges rather than allowing God to be at the center. Doesn't that sound familiar? Isn't it so easy for us to do that same thing? So how would Israel keep God at the center of everything? The ceremony that's prescribed by God back in Deuteronomy 27 that we see the Israelites carry out here in Joshua 8 was a means that God gave for Israel to do that very thing, to keep God at the center of everything. Three things let me quickly draw your attention to this morning. Three things that were significant parts of this ceremony. Three things that would help the Israelites and will help us to remember that God has to be at the center of everything. The first thing that God used in this ceremony to remind the Israelites that He had to be at the center of everything was His law, His word. There on the mountainside, what did God have Joshua do? Set up two large stones that had all the commandments of God engraved upon them. Two large stones where everyone could see them up on a mountainside. When you go away on a trip and you come back home on the interstate to Sturgis, how do you know you've arrived? There's a big white sign up on the hillside that says Sturgis on it, right? You know you're home when you see that. Well, Israel, how would they know that they were to obey God and obey His law? There were these two huge stones set up, plastered over with the law inscribed upon them to remind them that this land they were living in was God's land and it had to be lived in according to His law and His word. The law was designed by God to keep God at the center of life there in the promised land. Back in the beginning of the book of Joshua in verses 7 and 8, do you remember what God said to Joshua? He said, "Be careful to do all according to the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth. You shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it." Out of mercy, out of love, out of kindness, not because of anything Israel had done, God gave Israel the promised land. But God's telling them, "I've given you the land, but the only way blessing is going to come to you as you live in this land is if my law, my word, my presence is at the center of everything." Same is true in our lives. We can't expect God to bless our lives. We can't expect God to answer our prayers if we're choosing to live our life in a way that goes contrary to His law, to His word. And so as we come to verse 34 here in Joshua 8, we shouldn't be surprised to see what does Joshua do. He reads all the words of the law to the Israelites. Now you might see that and you may think, okay, he read the Ten Commandments to them. Oh, no, no, no. No, he read the book of Exodus and he read the book of Leviticus and he read the book of Deuteronomy. All the words of Moses he read to the people. That was not a 30-minute sermon, my friends. Today we live in an age where God's law is not just ignored, it's openly disregarded and trampled on, isn't it? We live in an age in which the line between right and wrong isn't just blurred, it's completely obliterated. Anything goes. There's no truth, no right and wrong. We live in a world where people manipulate financial markets and the political process to achieve whatever ends they want. There's no truth in politics. We live in a world today that says if it feels good, just go ahead and do it. A world that says if you want to try to fill that God-shaped hole with all kinds of other things, go ahead. It's perfectly okay. It'll all work out. But it doesn't. The world says, let something else take the place of God. Let money or power or sex or drugs or work or recreation fill up that empty space. Let those things become your gods. But they don't work. God gave us the law so that we would know the right way, the only way to fill up that empty place. Obedience to God's law is what keeps us from filling up that God-shaped hole with other things. Think how Jesus summarized the whole law of God. To love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. Do you realize that if you did that, you would never ever sin? You wouldn't need to worry about any of the other commandments if you could keep that one summary that Jesus gave us of what the law of God is. God has to be at the center. The God-shaped hole must be filled with God. Think how gracious the law of God really is. When God tells us we're to have no other gods before Him, why does He tell us that? Because God loves us and He knows the only thing that's going to fill that God-shaped hole is Him alone and nothing else. When we try to fill up our lives with things other than God, think of the misery that comes into our lives. Think of all the misery that's been caused by the sin of adultery, and yet our TVs and in the movies we watch, it's displayed prominently. And nothing detrimental is shown through those types of relationships. In fact, adultery and wrong sexual relationships are celebrated and exalted and made to look normal in our society. And the reason why is because people want to find something other than God to fill that emptiness up with. We get angry with people. We run them into the ground. We steal. We lie. We covet. All because we're trying to do this one thing, fill the emptiness up in our lives with something other than God. God gives us His law not so that we won't have any fun, but so that we'll live our lives in a way where He alone becomes the center of everything in our lives. So often we think, if I could just have this or just have that, this emptiness will go away and I'll feel good. But that emptiness won't go away unless God's the one who fills it. Eddie Vedder is the lead singer of a group called Pearl Jam, and when they released their second album, it set a record, selling more than 950,000 copies in 5 days. Eddie Vedder made the cover of Time magazine, and you would assume that all that success would have made him feel good about himself, but it didn't. Listen to what he said in an interview shortly after he was on the cover of Time. He said, "I'm being honest when I say that sometimes when I see a picture of the band or a picture of my face taking up the page of a magazine, I hate that guy." Even great success cannot fill that God-shaped hole. In a very real sense, when we try to fill that hole with things other than God, you know what happens? We actually become cursed. The whole purpose of God's law is to point us to blessedness, to point us to the blessings of having Him fill our lives in every way, because we were created to have God at the center. Look at verse 34 again. Joshua read the law to the people, and he read both the blessings and the curses that came as a result of either obedience or disobedience to the law of God. The blessings and the curses, that's the second thing I want to draw our attention to this morning. One side of the mountain, like I told you, Mount Gerizim, that was a mountain of blessing. Six of the tribes were there, and they pronounced blessings over those who kept the law as it was being read. The other side was Mount Ebal. Six of the tribes were there, pronouncing curses on those who did not keep the law. On one side, obedience. On the other side, disobedience. You know, there's two aspects to this idea of being blessed and cursed I want to draw our attention to this morning. First, consider the idea of being blessed or cursed in this life. Sometimes it seems like those who disregard God's law are having the best life, doesn't it? It seems like they get ahead, but I want you to remember Eddie Vedder, who I referred to earlier, the singer who hated himself. What a curse it would be to go through life feeling that way about yourself. Think what a curse it is to live your life trying to achieve and to get that which you can't possibly ever get or achieve. When we try to live our lives without God at the center, our lives are cursed and we're miserable. We're like Sisyphus, always trying to push that boulder up the hill. So many people are doing that today, deluded into worshiping a false god that can never be satisfied. In this life, there's a blessedness to knowing that God is at the center of our being. That is a place where you can find rest for your weary soul. When you fill that God-shaped hole with just God, we get the concept of being blessed by God so out of whack in Christianity today, don't we? What do we typically equate being blessed by God with? Getting all kinds of success and material things in life. We've been told the lie that blessing in a Christian's life consists of getting good things in your life. If we send some money here or there, if we say just the right prayer, if we do just the right things, God will bless us and we'll get whatever it is we want, whether it's a car or a job, a girlfriend, we'll be blessed. Neither Jesus nor God, though, ever promised that those who love Him would never face trouble in this life, did He? In fact, Jesus said in John 16:33, in this life you will have trouble. It's a guarantee. He illustrated that truth in a parable He told in Matthew 7. Remember the parable about the wise man and the foolish man? The foolish man built his house upon a sandy foundation, the wise man upon a rock. Jesus said at the end of that, therefore everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. I want you to notice something we often overlook in that parable. A storm hits the wise man's house just like it hits the foolish man's house. Being blessed isn't that no storms come into your life. It's that your house stands when the storms do come. Being blessed means that you withstand the storms of life rather than getting smashed by them. The fool tries to build his house on the shifting sands of pleasure and the pursuits of this life. When the storms come, the house collapses because there's nothing of any weight or substance to those things. Now think again about the parable that Jesus was teaching here in Matthew 7. What's the whole point of that parable? Look back at verse 24. Whoever hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. What does he mean by that? He's talking about obedience. Not just hearing the law of God, but actually living it out, putting it into practice. If you build your house in obedience to the words of Christ, in obedience to the law of God, you have a house that can withstand the storms of life. You will be blessed. Do you have that confidence in your life? Jesus said a few verses earlier in Matthew 7:21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. The ultimate blessing in life is to be part of the kingdom of heaven. That's what each of us should be living for. That's the only thing that's eternal. But what's Jesus saying in that verse? It's not enough to just give these things lip service. You have to give life service. Living in obedience to the Word of God. We're not saved by works. We're saved by Christ's sacrifice on our behalf. But to be saved means that you're a new creation in Christ with a new heart. You've been brought to life again. You're out of the valley of dry bones. And you have a heart that desires not just to be saved, but to serve the one who loved you and gave his life for you. To have him at the center of everything in your life. Does that describe you this morning? You see, this idea of being blessed and cursed, it's not just in this lifetime, but it also carries over into the judgment that is to come one day. In Matthew 25, Jesus talks about that final judgment. He gives a parable about it with sheep and with goats, and the sheep are put on the right, and they are blessed, and they enter the kingdom of heaven, and the goats are on the left, and they are cursed and sent to hell. Those who are blessed those who are cursed. There will come a day when Jesus will come again and He will judge all the peoples of the earth. And those who have lived their life by faith and trust in Him, seeking to have Him at the center of everything, go into a life of ultimate blessedness, eternal blessedness. And those who don't, go into a life of eternal cursedness. Those who have tried to fill that God-shaped hole with everything else by living for themselves will face an eternity in hell. And here's the problem we all face. If we're honest with ourselves, which one of these mountains are we truly standing on as we look at our lives? Are we truly standing on the mountain of blessing, or are we truly standing on the mountain of curses? Just like Israel, isn't it true we get distracted? Isn't it true that we wander away from God? And that brings us to the third thing I want to draw our attention to this morning. In Joshua 8:31, God tells Joshua to build an altar as part of all that's going on here. And where is that altar located? It's on Mount Ebal, the mountain of curses. Mount Ebal had the stones of the law with the law inscribed on them, and it also had an altar there on that mountain. Why were they there together? Because as Paul tells us, in our sinful flesh, we are incapable of keeping the law, and the only thing the law can do is to bring death. Think about why God had them build an altar there on the mountain of curses. You don't need an altar if you're there on the mountain of blessing. You don't need an altar if you're obeying all the law of the Lord. The altar was on the mountain of curses so that the people of Israel and we would know that there's a way back when we've sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. A place where a sacrifice could be made to take away the curse for sin. The altar is a picture of what's to come in Jesus, who provides a way back for us. A way for us to be reconciled to God. A way that we can have a right relationship with God so that God can indeed fill that God-shaped hole in our life. If you think you're situated on the mountain of blessing, then you don't see any need for that altar. But Jesus said, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Jesus is there for people who know where they stand. There for people who know they're there on that mountain of curses. There for people who know that they've been trying to fill that God-shaped hole up with everything other than God. If you believe you're on that mountain of blessing, you don't see a need for that altar. But you also don't see any need for Jesus. But if you think that, you're only deceiving yourself. Who's not tried to fill that God-shaped hole in their life with something other than God? We may deceive ourselves into thinking that we're filling that God-shaped hole with God, that we're better than we really are. But think about this. Can you really say that you have loved the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength this week? Can you really say that throughout this past week you've always loved your neighbor as yourself? Now, if we can't say those two things, do you know where that puts us? Right? Smack dab on the mountain of curses. We're a lawbreaker, cursed by the law. We desperately need that altar. We desperately need Jesus. Jesus is the only one who truly deserves to stand on the mountain of blessing. He's the only one who fulfilled the law and kept every word of it. He's the only one who lived his life with God truly at the center of his being. The only one who never tried to fill that God-shaped hole with anything other than God. But what does Christ do for us? He comes down off the mountain of blessing and He meets us on the mountain of curses. And He doesn't just meet us there. He takes the curse for us and offers Himself on the altar of the cross. And because Christ has done that, the curse is reversed. There is therefore no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. All of what's pictured here in the book of Joshua points us to Jesus, doesn't it? When in faith we cry out to Jesus to save us, what does He do? He comes away and He sweeps away all the broken pieces, all the broken things we've tried to fill our life with. And that allows God to begin to fill that God-shaped hole. Without Jesus, we will always be searching. We will never be satisfied. With Jesus, we find rest for our weary souls. I know it was a while ago, but do you remember where we started this morning? Why do we worship? We worship in response to what God has done for us. Here you see it clearly displayed. What has God done? He's come down off the mountain to offer Himself on the altar as a sacrifice to take the curse that we deserve so that we could get the blessings that He deserved. Now, how can you look at Jesus? How can you see what He's done for you and not worship Him? The more you look at the cross, the more you see Christ there sacrificed for you, you know what will happen? The more you'll worship Him. And the more you worship Him, the more His life, His presence will fill the emptiness that's in your life. C.S. Lewis said, "Look for yourself and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ and you will find Him, and with Him, everything else thrown in." I want you to know this morning. Only Jesus can fill that God-shaped hole. And so as we close in prayer, would you do this? Would you ask Jesus to come and to fill that empty place in your life, to take away your longing for anything other than Him, so that His presence and His alone fills your life. Ask Him to come and sweep away all the debris of the shattered hopes and dreams that you've been living for. Ask Him to fill your heart so that you can find your rest in Him. Let's pray. Father, we